This is a public lecture hosted by the Johnson Shoyama Graduate School of Public Policy. The school is, as many of you know, a joint initiative between the University of Saskatchewan and the University of Regina, and in that respect it is unique. The graduate program is delivered on two campuses, sometimes with one of them as a remote center, thus allowing us to draw on resources from the two universities. While it is a relatively new school, I think we have sufficient evidence to declare that it has been a success, proving that you can in fact be in two places at one time. In fact, today we are going to be in three places at one time, as two audiences in Regina will join us, one from the University of Regina main campus, and I think you will shortly see them on one of our screens here, and the other from a College Drive location. Greetings to our Regina audience if they are currently seeing us. During the question and answer period, folks from here will come to the front to use that microphone, and we will intersperse those questions with questions from our Regina audiences. In addition to our core business of teaching and research in the area of public policy, we also hold at the School of Public Policy these public lectures. These are partly for the professional development of our faculty and for our graduate students, but also primarily for the public who may have an interest in public policy issues. Today, Bob Lucas of the Department of Economics at the University of Saskatchewan will inform us about sovereign default, thinking the unthinkable. A pretty grim and scary topic, perhaps appropriate for this blustery day. I really feel like we should have had some horror movie music to accompany him, but we don't. Apologies. It is my pleasure to introduce a colleague, Dr. Robert Lucas, a native of Saskatchewan who received his Bachelor of Arts degree here from our university, and then his PhD from Brown University. He has held teaching positions at the Washington State University, at the University of California at Los Angeles. Dr. Lucas's research interests include monetary theory and macroeconomic theory. Journals where his work has appeared include the very top journals, the American Economic Review, the Review of Economics and Statistics, Canadian Journal of Economics, Oxford Economic Papers, the Manchester School, Canadian Public Policy, and the Journal of International Trade and Economic Development. In addition, Dr. Lucas has collaborated with Robert Barrow of Harvard University in writing a macroeconomic theory textbook. Certainly very well qualified indeed to tell us today about sovereign default, and I will turn it over to you, Bob.
Thank you, Rose, and thank you for coming out on this blustery day. Today I'm going to talk about sovereign default. Some of you may have heard a presentation I made in early 2009 on the financial crisis, the world financial crisis. The fact that I'm now talking about sovereign default is not coincidental. This is the second stage, typically, of financial crises. So let's think about the overview of the talk. I'm going to start with some preliminary accounting, and I apologize, there will have to be a little bit of algebra, but it won't last long. Then I'm going to define default. I'm going to talk about the chronology of a sovereign crisis. I'm going to talk about the consequences of a sovereign default. And in this section of the talk, I will distinguish between external and domestic default. That's an important consideration. And then I'm going to go through four case studies, Ireland, Greece, Italy, and the United States, all of which you will have read about in the last 2 years. So again, let's start with some preliminary accounting. I'm going to talk about budget constraints. There are two types of constraints I'll introduce. The first is the government budget constraint. An annual one, and here it is, equation one. I define BGT as the nominal debt outstanding of a country, say on January 1st of 2010, and so BGT plus one would be the same variable in January 1st, 2011. So it's the growth in the debt over the year in question, and it's identically equal to government expenditures minus tax revenue. And if that part of the equation is positive, we define that as a positive deficit. Now we can break down the government expenditures into three categories. We have G, which is purchases of goods and services. These are the purchases that show up in the national accounts. They generate income of an equivalent amount. And the second two items in the parentheses are known as transfer payments. They simply are activity where the government takes from you and gives back to you, transfers back and forth. It does not generate, they do not generate income on an aggregate basis. The two categories are interest on the public debt, and I have denoted that by the interest rate I times the amount of debt outstanding. Of course, this debt outstanding was issued at various times in the past, and so you should think of this as a vector of multiplication. Different issues of debt have different interest rates on them, but that's the notation I will use. The other term in parentheses I just have called other transfer payments. Net of, not including debt, these are welfare payments, Social Security, public pension plans if they're funded out of general revenue. And then we can play around with it a little bit more. In the third equation, I have subtracted other transfer payments from taxes. And now I've got on the right-hand side of equation three, government spending minus net taxes. That's the net revenue the government receives. That's known as a structural deficit, and that's going to play a role in the discussion that comes forward. And then we leave the interest payments on the debt as a separate entity. And so equation three will be the principal equation I'll be using in this talk. Now, the problem with these figures that I have introduced is they're in nominal terms, dollar amounts, and so for large countries like the United States, they tend to be in trillions of dollars. And it's a little hard to get an idea of the economic significance of these numbers. And so we use an analogy with an individual. The ability of an individual to carry debt is based on his or her income. And so what we're going to do with this equation is we're going to divide all of the variables by nominal GDP of the country to get a measure of how significant these debt variables and spending variables are relative to GDP. And if we do that and do a little more algebra, which I'll spare you we get the following. Define the lowercase letter as the debt to GDP ratio of the corresponding variables in equation 3. And now I've got the change in the debt to GDP ratio in equation 4. And that's equal to structural deficit expressed, again, relative to income, plus the second term, which is real interest rate minus the growth rate of real GDP times the outstanding debt to GDP ratio. Now, the real interest rate is the nominal interest rate minus inflation. In a low inflation environment such as we have, you can think of R as being the proxy for R as the nominal interest rate. So equation 4 will give us a rule for governing how this debt to GDP ratio changes over time. On an annual basis. Now, there's a second important budget constraint, which I'll call the intertemporal budget constraint, and it's built up from the constraints that I've just introduced. So we rewrite equation 3 as 5. This is the same as 3. I've just changed the order of the variables. And then we update equation 5 by one period. In other words, if 5 holds in 2010, it's certainly going to hold in 2011. And so we obtain that one. And you'll notice in equation 6, BG T plus 1 appears as it does in equation 5. So we can use this to interconnect the two annual budget constraints by solving 6 for BG T plus 1 and substitute it into 5. And rearrange, and we get something looks a little nasty. In equation 7, we've got the principal and interest of the government debt. In the second parentheses, we've got the present value of government spending over the 2 years. On the right-hand side, we've got the present value of tax, net taxes, and then this terminal, the debt in period T plus 2, brought back to the present. Now, if we do this for the foreseeable future, we get a budget constraint going into the future as far as we want. And so I will just write it out in this fashion. Principal and interest of the government debt outstanding plus the present value of government spending equals the present value of net taxes. And you'll notice there's not a terminal condition because I've invoked a non-Ponzi scheme condition. The governments eventually have to pay for things. So this is basically the equation I'm going to use to define default or bankruptcy. And here it is. Bankruptcy occurs when the holders of government debt conclude that the intertemporal budget constraint is violated. That is, the projected path of spending and tax revenue net of other transfers is such that equation 9 holds. Now, there's a number of features of this definition. The first is that present value calculations involve forecasts into the future. There are expectations, and these expectations can change very quickly. So people can decide today a government is in default, even though yesterday they did not think so. So that's the first point about sovereign debt. It comes on very quickly. Now, how do people form expectations of equation 9? Well, two variables which they use are the debt to GDP ratio, B, and the change in the debt to GDP ratio, informing expectations of how likely 9 will occur. Furthermore, as the probability of bankruptcy increases, so also does the nominal and real interest rate that holders of government debt demand in order to continue holding the government debt. And this rise in the nominal interest rate is going to play a role in the debt spiral that I will speak of momentarily. So let's talk about the chronology of a sovereign crisis in general terms. A high debt to GDP ratio does not by itself trigger a sovereign debt crisis, but it increases the country's vulnerability to experiencing one. The typical initiating event is a financial crisis that produces a prolonged recession with large declines in income and employment. The recession generates a sharp decline in tax revenue because taxes are a function of GDP, a rise in other transfer payments, unemployment insurance, social welfare, bailouts, and an increase in stimulus spending. And we saw all of these occur in many countries over the last 2 or 3 years. Combined effects of these changes leads to an explosion of government debt and a large increase in the debt to GDP ratio. As the debt-to-GDP ratio rises, so also does the probability of default, and as a consequence, the interest rate on new and maturing debt increases, reinforcing the explosion in the debt-to-GDP ratio. So this is a standard sequence of events which we will see in all three of the four cases that I'm going to introduce. Now, what are the consequences of a default? And here it's really important to distinguish between two types of defaults. And the first one I will talk about is government debt held by domestic nationals. Now, there is no particular case where it's either one or the other. The other is where the government debt is held by foreign nationals. It's usually on a continuum, but think about it as one extreme or the other. So what happens if a government defaults on debt that is held domestically? The default impairs the domestic banking system, as banks have to write down their value of their assets. This write-down may lead to additional systemic crisis with the collapse in financial intermediation. All public and private pension plans and private saving plans experience sharp declines in value. Collapse in financial intermediation and wealth leads to a large decline in spending, resulting in further contractions in income and employment. And so, because of the severe consequences for the real economy, governments rarely default explicitly on domestic debt. What do they do to prevent it? Well, the first approach is fiscal structural reform. Lower G. Think cuts public sector employment and other transfer payments, and raise taxes by increasing tax rates. And a severe decrease in G and a sharp increase in T can bring about the the intertemporal budget back into balance, particularly if the new policies are maintained for a period of time. The problem is that the immediate impact of these policies is to exacerbate the recession as the growth rate of real GDP becomes more negative, because all of these structural reforms have a negative effect on the current environment. So looking at our law for governing the change in the debt to GDP ratio, as the recession develops, n turns negative, multiply a negative by a negative, that adds to the debt to GDP ratio. And so its direct impact is reinforced by the indirect impact effect on taxes. Taxes fall, and the probability of default rises along with R. So three of those variables are now automatically responding to lead to a growth in the debt to GDP ratio. And so this is the way a debt spiral can be initiated, notwithstanding the attempts to bring the intertemporal budget into balance. Because of this possibility, governments have in the past found another way to prevent default, and that is to sell new and maturing debt to the central bank. And this policy generates new revenue to augment net tax revenue without feeding into this debt spiral. The problem is when the central bank buys the debt, it issues credits which can be converted into currency, which we know is known as high-powered money, which leads to a rapid increase in the money supply. And the rapid expansion of the money supply generates surprise inflation. So rather than defaulting by writing down the nominal value of outstanding debt, surprise inflation reduces the purchasing power of this debt. So the net result for B is the same as an explicit default. It's just that you are raising the denominator instead of lowering the numerator. And this policy was the principal means of avoiding explicit default prior to the 20th century. Now, a danger of this policy is hyperinflation, as the sale of debt to the central bank accelerates. And the classic example is that of Germany in 21 to 23. In 2 years, the price level rose by a factor of 2.22 times 10 to the 10, which is a big number, causing massive redistributions of wealth. And that's sort of a passive way of saying something very traumatic happened. That led to a complete breakdown in the social order in Germany, and it gave rise to the environment wherein the brown shirts, which later morphed into the Nazis, were able to seize political control. So these are effects of some import. So now let's turn to an external default. External defaults, in some sense, are better because the debt is held by foreign nationals. So the domestic economy is spared all of the consequences I have talked about to the extent that foreigners feel the brunt of the default. Now, the default typically means that you can't go back into international markets the next day and start borrowing again. So you are essentially saying, you are essentially foregoing international credit markets for the foreseeable future. Now, this loss of access is not as bad as one might think if the structural deficit is zero. So I've reproduced equation three on the screen. And you'll note that on the right-hand side, if you default, I.BGT disappears. If G and T are in balance, that means the left-hand side is zero. You have no need to borrow. So the critical factor for a country in thinking about default is the state of the structural deficit. If it's big, then it has to be financed, then they're not going to want to default. So once the structural deficit is close to zero, default on external debt is much more likely, and in this gives the country some negotiating power to go to the creditors and say, look, I can default and you will get nothing, so let's negotiate default. And this is known as a structured default. This negotiation involves a number of features. The first thing is a partial write-down in the nominal value of the existing debt, which has been given the name of a haircut. The second component is a restructuring that involves a swap of debt about to mature for debt of longer maturity and lower interest rates. Credible commitments for fiscal structural reform, because your creditors are now going to take a 30-year bond and they want to have some assurance that over the next 30 years the interest payments will be made. So the way you achieve that is that you implement structural reform involving lower future G and OTP and higher future T. And the important fourth one is very important, extra short-term lending to finance the current deficit until the structural reforms take effect. So if properly executed, a negotiated default can avoid the debt spiral that results if the reform focuses solely on eliminating the current deficit. And that's a very important point. Negotiated defaults. Thus, a successful settlement will bring the intertemporal budget back into balance by changing all four components of the budget while simultaneously financing the current deficit. So if you look at the intertemporal budget deficit again, I falls because that is part of the negotiation. BGT falls, the haircut. Present value of G falls, and the present value of T net rises. So all four of those components contribute to the resolution of the intertemporal budget. So let's talk about external default or restructuring over the last 200 years. This picture is taken from Reinhardt and Rogoff. This time is different, the definitive study of financial crises. They took a sample of about 65 countries, and for each year, those countries in the sample that were independent were either in default or restructuring or not. And on the vertical axis, we've got the percentage of countries in external default. And some of this goes to 50%. So we're not looking at something new here. This is the history of the world. Now, this makes it look worse than it is because many of the countries that are defaulting or restructuring are very small countries. And if you weighted these countries by their GDP, the figure wouldn't look so dramatic. But underneath the figure, I've listed some defaults of some countries in Europe. Let me put that down. Spain, 13 times. France, 8. Germany, 8. Austria, 7. Hungary, 7. Portugal, 6. Greece, 5. So even large countries have experienced many defaults over the last 200 years. So now let's turn to the European sovereign debt crisis. And a couple of preliminary remarks. The debt crisis of the euro combines the features of both domestic and external debt crises. In a monetary union, domestic control over the currency is transferred to a central body, the ECB, the European Central Bank. Now, in the deliberations in the 90s that established the central bank, Germany insisted that the primary method of dealing with domestic default, which is the sale of debt to the central bank, is not allowed, no doubt due to their memories of what happened in 21 to 23. Therefore, the charter of the ECB does not allow it to purchase the sovereign debt of individual countries that run into difficulty. So as soon as you remove the principal way of dealing with defaults, you have to ensure that the defaults don't occur. So that the original treaty also required that countries could not join the monetary union until the deficit to GDP ratio was 3% or less, and the debt to GDP ratio was 60% or less. So this was the fail-safe, if you like, given that we've taken away selling debt to the central bank as a means of dealing with the crisis. This was going to eliminate the possibility of debt crises. The important point was that there was no provision for enforcing the compliance of member states once they got into the Union. And this has come back to haunt the EU, as we'll see. So the sovereign debt of individual countries, Ireland and Greece, was purchased by banks and pension plans throughout the Eurozone. So from the perspective of Euro creditors, think Germany and France, a default in the sovereign debt of Ireland or Greece generates consequences similar to a domestic default. From the perspective of Euro debtors, a default can either be viewed as an external default, Ireland and Greece, or a domestic default if the sovereign debt is held primarily by domestic agents, Italy and Spain. And this difference of perspective is important for understanding dynamics of negotiations among the Euro countries over the appropriate resolution of the default crises of individual countries. So let's turn to some examples now. And I'll begin with Ireland because they experienced the first crisis. Of all the current sovereign debt crises, Ireland's is most directly tied to the housing bubble that preceded the world financial crisis of 2007-08. Between 96 and 2006, the national index of housing prices rose 270%. In 2006, more than 17% of the total non-farm workforce was in construction, a figure that rises to 20% if one includes jobs in the service sector related to construction. Michael Lewis, the columnist who's written on this period, suggested that by 2006, everybody was either buying a house, selling a house, or building a house in Ireland. And the last important part of the puzzle was from 2000 on, the bank lending that fueled this bubble relied increasingly on short-term, three-month debt sold externally in the interbank market. That is, they borrowed from other banks around the world rather than the traditional way of receiving deposits from households. So the net external debt of Irish banks rose from 20% of GDP in 2003 to 70% in 2008. So Ireland was really posed to suffer some rather severe consequences if housing prices ever started declining. Well, there's the picture. The upper line is Dublin housing prices. The lower line is housing prices in Ireland total. And you'll notice the peak was reached in 2007, and from that point on, they fell dramatically and continuously. So the crisis chronology is fairly straightforward. When the bubble burst in 2007, prices began declining. Borrowing in the overnight market became difficult because lenders knew the Irish banks were in trouble because the value of their assets were declining. And Irish banks were forced to cover their shortfall with loans from the Irish Central Bank and the European Central Bank. By 2008, banks were experiencing large-scale redemptions. There was a full-scale bank run. And on a fateful day in September, the finance minister, late finance minister Brian Lenihan, guaranteed the debt of the six main Irish banks. In effect, this decision converted private debt to public debt due to a confusion between liquidity and insolvency of the banking system. And this is an important distinction. An illiquid bank is a bank that has good assets, has a temporary problem with sources of financing those assets. An insolvent bank is a bank that has bad assets, and therefore it's not a problem with liquidity. The bank is essentially bankrupt because the value of assets has fallen so much it cannot cover the value of its deposits. Lenihan was told the banking system was sound. It was a liquidity crisis. And I think one of the major banks in the United States, how can I forget its name, provided proof of that. They were one of the banks that was lending to Irish banks. And so, basically, he just converted the private debt of banks to the public, rather than just letting the banking system collapse, refinance banks and start over, as other countries did. Over the next 2 years, additional government attempts to recapitalize some banks and nationalize others contributed to a government deficit of 32% of GDP in 2010. The recession that began in 2008 peaked in 2009. Remember, 20% of the economy suddenly disappears as house building stops, with a decline of 10% in real GDP, the largest decline in the Eurozone. Negative growth in real GDP, together with the efforts to refinance the banking system, generated an increase in the debt-to-GDP ratio from 25% in 2007 to 95% in 2010. So suddenly the Irish tiger became the Irish basket case. As the debt-to-GDP ratio grew, so also did the interest rate on government debt as markets began to consider the possibility of default. By October of 2010, interest rates on 10-year bonds had reached 7%, a level that was considered unsustainable. So this perfect storm of a large structural deficit, high interest rates, and negative GDP growth led to a euro bailout in 2010. And the bailout had a number of common features, a 85 billion euro loan from the European Financial Stabilization Fund, 53% contributed by European governments, 26% from the IMF, and the remaining from the Irish Central Bank cash reserves and National Pension Fund. And the interest rate was pegged at 5.8%. This loan represents about $25,000 per man, woman, and child in Ireland. The loan is dependent on austerity measures, including large cuts in welfare payments, a rise in the value-added tax, and thousands of layoffs in the public sector. Bring the structural deficit under control. The loan is to finance the current deficit until structural reforms can be implemented to bring the intertemporal budget into balance. Note the absence of haircuts or restructuring. Private holders of Irish debt receive full repayment of maturing debt, even though the day that Lenihan nationalized the bank debt, it was being traded in New York money markets at 50 cents on the dollar. So it wasn't criminal because it was based on ignorance, but I don't know what you call it. It was a bad decision. The bailout occurred because of the fear of contagion in the Eurozone if Ireland defaulted, and the tepid recovery of real GDP in 2011 has increased the probability of another bailout package, and austerity measures are forecast to remain in effect until at least 2014. So again, to quote Michael, and in 2011, the government suffered the worst defeat of a sitting government since the formation of the Irish state. And to quote Michael Lewis again, the bank sank the economy and the government. Let's turn to Greece that has been filling the newspapers recently. The origin of the crisis, in contrast to the Irish question, the Greek debt crisis began long before the financial crisis of 2007-08. To achieve the debt-to-GDP and deficit-to-GDP targets to qualify for entry to the European Union, Monetary Union, Greece understated the magnitude of its annual deficit. Once it was in, the Greek deficit averaged about 3.5% of GDP, although there is some question about the quality of this data. A former budget minister suggests the official figure of 1.5% in 2004 was actually 8.3%. And when he went to the prime minister and asked to have the government do something about that, the reply was, look, this is the Olympics year. Don't rock the boat. This issue was masked by strong real GDP growth of close to 4%. Remember, if the denominator is rising by 4%, that will handle the deficit of 3.5%. As a result, the official debt-to-GDP ratio was relatively stable, but exceeded 100% of GDP over the whole period. So you'll notice until 2008, up to 2008, it was relatively stable. But you have to remember that this was occurring, the number of things that happened that suggest that GDP ratio should have fallen from 2000 to 2008. First thing that happened was when they joined the euro, borrowing costs fell dramatically, and in fact they started borrowing in the same terms as Germany because market participants thought that the euro would stand by Greece. In retrospect, not a great forecast. But interest borrowing costs fell, and in fact there were periods between 2000 and 2008 where R was actually negative. It should be reducing the debt to GDP ratio. N is positive, that should be reducing debt to GDP ratio. The fact that it didn't really change much from 2000 to 2008 suggests the structural deficit was growing and offsetting these positive influences. So, with an economy heavily reliant on shipping and tourism, Greece's GDP declined rapidly in 2009 with the onset of the global recession. In October of 2009, the newly elected government admitted that the previous government had been manipulating the nation's economic data on debt and deficits. The deficit was revised upward from 3.6% to 12.8% of GDP, which has since been revised to 15.4%. The Greek government brought in a Michigan professor of economics to run the statistics division of the government. And he was recently quoted as saying, in any other country, statistics is a rather boring subject. In Greece, it's a blood sport. By May of 2010, Greece was unable to access world credit markets. It was given a loan of $110 billion from the European Financial Stabilization Fund, staggered over 2 years, with the idea that successive payments would be made only if structural reform of the government budget occurred. Cutbacks in G and OTR contributed to a decline in real GDP of 4.5% in 2010, with a corresponding collapse in taxation revenue. And so now we got into a debt spiral as the debt to GDP ratio rose to 127%. In 2011, real GDP declined by 6%, the debt to GDP ratio rose to 143, and it was forecast to reach 160. By 2012. It quickly became apparent that Greece could no longer repay the principal and interest payments on its debt, and the only question was whether the default would be disorderly or structured. Since about 60% of Greek debt is held externally, some argued that Greece should simply default. Disorderly default was not feasible because the 2011 structural deficit was about 9% of GDP. So in order to pay the police and the fire and teachers, Greece needed to borrow to finance its operations. This is a picture of who holds the Greek debt. Of that 58% that's held externally, the foreign troika, known as the EU, IMF, and ECB, owns 11%. Foreign banks 16, and foreign other 31. So this 58% held within the eurozone was the reason why the eurozone wanted to bail out Greece. They eventually want some return on those funds. In 2011, in October, on the verge of an unstructured Greek default, Merkel and Sarkozy engineered a structural default. And as I've talked about it before, it had all the features. Another bailout of $130 billion, a haircut of 50% on private holders of Greek debt, a restructuring of remaining debt, extending the maturity to 30 years with an interest rate of 3.5 to 4%, which is an effective haircut of 70% on those holders because they are having to, not only are they having to lend for another 30 years, they're having to lend below at below market interest rates. So when you do the calculations, that adds up to they're only getting 30 cents on the dollar. Additional reforms to deal with tax evasion. The OECD estimates that Greece loses up to 4% of GDP a year in lost tax revenue due to tax evasion. former official of the tax department recently spoke at a conference and talked about the 40-40-20 rule. If you had a $100 bill, tax bill owed to the government, you would go see a tax agent. Tax agent would reduce your tax bill to $20. You would demand $40 in payment, and you would get a net $40 reduction in your tax bill. That's the 40-40-20 rule. They're trying to deal with that. Generous entitlements. At the beginning of their difficulties, you could take early retirement at 55, I think, in Greece. And this was a pension fund that was funded directly out of tax revenue. It was unfunded. And a public sector that is 40% of GDP, that has to be reduced. Then, right in the midst of this negotiation, the PM decided to hold a referendum, and you may recall that he was summoned to a meeting with Merkel and Sarkozy and said, if you hold a referendum, you're out of the union. So instead of a referendum, they replaced him with a technocratic government led by Papademos, a former central banker and economist. With reforms, the hope is that B will fall to 120% by 2020. So we're not looking at there's a real serious problem for Greece, and they're going to be under the gun for a long, long time. Even though this agreement was announced in October, it wasn't until the last week of February this year that the Greek Parliament finally signed on to these structural reforms, and that was the last round of austerity, which led to the rioting streets of Athens in February. Just today I read that the haircut has to be voluntary in a technical sense. If the holders of the Greek debt do not agree to the haircut, then you initiate credit default swaps, which are insurance schemes that are sold on this, and that raises the possibility of contagion if people have to start making good on the insurance. So what they do is if they buy into the haircut, the default is called voluntary and credit default swaps will not be enforced. As of today, only 90% of the private holders have agreed to the default haircut. So it's not clear that we're out of the woods yet on this agreement. It still works. That is one reason attributed for the fall of the stock market today. That's another question. Let's move to Italy. Origin of the crisis. Zero GDP growth over the last decade generated a debt to GDP ratio of 116%, even though the structural deficit has been close to zero. What's been happening is zero growth and interest payments to be made, the debt to GDP ratio will rise, according to equation three I gave. The recession of 08-09 reduced real GDP by 7%, which generated structural deficit, forecasts of low and even negative real GDP growth into 2013 and beyond compounded the problem. In fact, the growth of GDP in Italy has been third lowest in the world over the last 10 years. Throughout 2010 and early 2011, the coalition government of Berlusconi failed to pass legislation to address the situation, as we now know, he had other things on his mind. So the real problem was that the Italian GDP is 16% of the Eurozone. So unlike Greece, that is only 1.8%, the very size of Italy raises the question whether the European Financial Stabilization Fund would have sufficient funds to bail out Italy should it need assistance. Well, the crisis chronology again. The crisis peaked in November of last year when Italy was forced to pay 7.3% interest on new 10-year bonds, a level that is not considered sustainable, as it threatened to initiate a debt spiral. In mid-November, the Italian government failed. A confidence motion was replaced by a technocratic government led by Mario Monti, a professor of economics and former EU commissioner. The propensity of politicians around the world to step away from the problem and appoint professors of economics to deal with it is going to simply reinforce the reputation of economics as a dismal science. The Monti government began to implement structural reforms to reduce government spending, reform the public pension plan, and to reduce tax evasion. And now I will make the one prediction that Italy will not default. And the reasons are the majority of Italian public debt is held internally, so the political and economic costs of default is prohibitive. The average maturity of Italian debt is about 7 years. Therefore, it is less likely to face significantly higher interest rates on most of its debt in the short term. Another way of thinking of it is it has about 7 years to bring its structural deficit into balance and to reduce the debt to GDP ratio to more sustainable levels through structural reforms before a debt spiral develops. So it's got some breathing. And the recent decline in borrowing costs indicates that markets believe the new government of Italy has introduced credible structural reforms to deal with its fiscal situation. Well, along with the immediate problem of dealing with each country as it went into crisis, Germany and France have spearheaded an attempt to reform the union, to address the fundamental problem of lack of fiscal union. And characterized the initial formation of the monetary union. So that's the Maastricht Treaty was a 91 treaty that established rules for joining the EMU. You had to meet the following conditions: max inflation of 1.5%, a maximum debt to GDP ratio of 60%, maximum deficit to GDP ratio of 3%. The important property was that no enforcement mechanism was in place once countries joined the EMU. And for example, in 2002-03, both France and Germany violated the guidelines on the deficit. And other countries, notably Greece, routinely violated the guidelines over the past 10 years. So to address this fundamental problem of a lack of fiscal authority, Germany and France succeeded in getting the other countries of the European community to sign a fiscal compact in December of 2011. It was characterized as a treaty between governments because if they start playing around with the constitution of the monetary union that has to go to plebiscites, and these days nobody wants to take these proposals to the population. Caps the structural deficit at 0.5% GDP, automatic penalties for countries whose deficit exceeds 3%, rules to be enshrined in the country's constitutions, and a new European stabilization mechanism operational in July of this year. UK and the Czech Republic opted out. UK was simply not willing to give up the control over the fiscal authority, but the other countries did, and this is, I think, a significant change in the environment in Europe that will help rule out these crises in the future. Once the fiscal reform was in place, the European Central Bank then said, okay, now we're going to step in and help. Now, they can't help directly by buying government debt. What they did was they announced a program of three-year loans at very low interest rates, around 1%, to commercial banks. Well, the idea is, since they lend to the commercial banks will then have the liquidity to buy the government debt. And so they're going to help address the issue in that fashion. It was wildly successful. Close to €500 million was taken up in February. Another €500 billion was borrowed in December, and another €530 billion was borrowed in late February. Most of this right now is sitting on deposit at the ECB because the banks have just taken a 1% loan and put it back in the ECB where they can get more than 1% interest. It's a no-brainer. But some of it has leaked out into the general economy as well, and some of these funds have been used to purchase sovereign European debt. So once the ECB initiated this program, the fear of another liquidity crisis in Europe diminished quite dramatically, along with interest rates on most euro sovereign debt. So it appears that they seem to have policies in place to get us out of the current crisis. I want to spend the remaining time to talk about the USA, and I'll begin with the artificial crisis, which was the debt ceiling crisis of August 2011. And it will become clear why I think it's artificial. It's not a default crisis as defined as a violation of the intertemporal budget constraint. It comes about because Congress establishes a maximum level of debt. And once the current debt level starts getting close to the limit, Congress has to pass another law increasing the debt limit. And if they do not do that, the government cannot legally borrow. So let's think about the annual budget constraint again. When BGT rises to its limit, the failure to raise the debt ceiling results in the following constraint: zero. No borrowing. No new borrowing. Well, let's look at the budget deficit. High BGT has to occur because you have to make payments on the existing debt or you do default, technically. Taxes cannot be changed dramatically. And so the only way to satisfy 3A once the ceiling is reached is to shut down the government, send public sector employees home. And this did happen in December of 1995. Newt Gingrich, the same one that's running for president, controlled the Congress. He sent a budget to Clinton, and Clinton refused to sign it. So the debt limit was reached, and we had a shutdown of the government. It didn't last very long because the Republicans quickly determined that the public was not on their side, and so it was resolved. But it has happened in the past. Now, it was estimated that the debt crisis was going to, the ceiling was going to be reached on August the 1st of last year. And a political stalemate developed in the Congress as Republicans, under the influence of the Tea Party, refused attempts of the Democrats to raise additional tax revenue to address the large annual deficit of 9%. Their line in the sand was no additional tax. On July 31st, a deal was struck to raise the debt ceiling, along with a proposal to cut spending by $2.4 trillion over the next 2 years. And these were going to be automatic cuts. Everybody put in their own safety valve. The Democrats ensured that national defense would fall by $500 billion automatically, thinking that the Republicans would never let that happen. But it was, if nothing happens, these things are going to occur in 2 years automatically. They also established a bipartisan committee to find additional savings by the end of the year so that these automatic cuts would not have to start. The day after the the agreement, S&P downgraded the U.S. debt, since the deadlock in addressing the growth rate in federal debt appears to be in place at least till the election this fall. Even though it was an artificial crisis, these artificial crises can have real effects. Markets around the world experienced heavy losses. The Dow Jones dropped 5.6% in one day. It does not generate a lot of confidence in the economic management of the U.S. The bipartisan committee reported a failure to reach consensus in November. And the congressional deadlock will continue at least until 2012 election, as each party hopes to achieve a majority in both houses to enact its preferred solution. Republicans focus on entitlement and spending cuts. Democrats tend to favor tax increases. If the election does not resolve the impasse, then the parties will have to negotiate a path of spending and taxation revenue that will be sustainable in the longer term. Now, this is the artificial crisis. The United States is facing a real problem. This is a picture taken from the Bowles-Simpson Commission, which President Obama set up in 2010 in an attempt to arrive at a consensus on how to deal with the projected path of spending and taxation. And you'll notice in 2010, the debt to GDP ratio was only 60%. It has since risen to about 73%, but it's still not in, we're not in crisis mode here. The problem is looking forward, and there are three scenarios in that diagram. The red line is the current law, and under the current law, it appears there's no problem. Debt to GDP ratio will continue, but never gets much over 80%. The problem with the current law is that it keeps getting modified. The Bush tax cuts of 2001 and 2003 were supposed to expire a year ago. 2 years ago, they were extended. They could easily be extended again in 2012. So the current law is not the relevant. It's the current policy, which is the green line. That is, if the U.S. Congress continues to do what it has in the past under current policy, the debt-to-GDP ratio explodes, or is not sustainable. And as I think it was George Stiglitz who says, something that is not sustainable probably won't happen. But it shows you the necessity of taking some action. The third line, the blue line, is the Commission proposal, which is a combination of spending cuts and taxation revenue-enhancing policies. And under the Commission proposal, you'll notice that the debt to GDP ratio continuously declines into the foreseeable future. The question is, why hasn't Obama utilized this Commission proposal? Because in his current budget proposals, he did not adopt many of the Commission proposals. And I think the only answer there is that he has made the judgment that until Republicans decide to negotiate in good faith, there's no point in negotiating. And so he has gone to the other Democrat, he's tilted towards the Democratic position of tax increases. In passing, there's a lot of changes you can make in the U.S. tax code that don't involve tax rate increases. For example, if you list the countries where U.S. companies book the largest profits, three of the top five companies are Ireland, Luxembourg, and Bermuda. And the U.S. profits that are generated in Bermuda are 646% of Bermuda GDP. So it's pretty clear that U.S. companies are gaming the system, booking profits in low taxation areas of the world to reduce their tax. It's legal, but all you have to do is change the law, and this would stop. So there are many proposals now to modify or change the U.S. tax code, and that probably will be the focus over the next 2 years, is reform of the U.S. tax code to deal with the problems implied by the current policy. So that's it for my prepared remarks. A couple of books I would point you to if you're interested in pursuing this a little further. Reinhardt and Rogoff, This Time is Different, is the, as I suggested, the definitive work on financial crises and sovereign debt crises over the last 800 years. It's not bedtime reading, but it will reward you with some insights. If you are more interested in reading about the human side of these crises, Michael Lewis has produced a book called Boomerang Travels in the New Third World, which is us now. And it's based on a number of articles he published in Vanity Fair, where he goes through some of the personal aspects of these crises in different countries. A highly readable account. So I'd like to now open the floor for questions or discussions.